morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We've got a packed show for you today. We're going to be speaking to furniture designer Peter Danko in a little bit, and we're going to be speaking to author Robert Olin Butler. Right now, I would like to welcome poet Reggie Kabiko. He's a slam poet, spoken and written word poet, theater artist, stand-up comedian. He will be reading tonight along with Jimmy Santiago Baca at 7 o'clock in the Vox Performa series at the CCA right here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Hey, Santa Fe.
It's great to have you.
I'm excited to be here. This is like my first coffee chat radio interview reading, so.
And we hope not your last.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
I thought we could start with one of your poems.
Sure. Upon recalling the Filipino dishes I do not know how to cook, sometimes you grow bored of the dark, sizzling jungle of a wok, and you remember how celery, carrots, the whole long story of an onion kept you transfixed in the sign of cancer. You long to break into the metropolis of noodles. Vinegared poultry parts scream, I love you, I love you, I love you. The stove is stuck on fire while your toes lash out for a dinner napkin. You're a Pascal pork basted in ginger ale waiting for black pepper. Chopped garlic outweighs you with its skin crackling karaoke. The spatula has seen the agony of Goya and knows the oily beauty of fish sauce. Like an overworked gospel singer, the white platter grows enormous with olives. You plunge a pitchfork into the shredded bits of goat your father serenaded with his holy cleaver. He whistles the same sutra for shrimp, plump and pink as Joan of Arc, before dunking them in a sacrament of scalding broth. Bites a baby empanada and engulf a herd of angels. Rinse it with a mystic splash of ginger tea. Your body is that one pagoda, that pillar of salty regret, that hungry bottle of a slim American sailor that has devoured all the stellar secrets plucked from your inner whore.
Reggie Kabiko, poet who will be reading tonight at the CCA. Why do you laugh?
I don't know. I'm just in this food mood, and so I'm just getting hungry when I'm here in Santa Fe. I guess it's seeing those chili peppers and everywhere. And
well, I would think you'd get hungry reading your own poetry.
Sometimes.
You're Filipino-American, but only somewhat connected to Filipino culture?
Well, I was born here, and I grew up in southern Maryland, and it was 50% redneck and 50% black, and we were the first Filipino family to move. And so I guess when you're in between cultures, you sort of have this observation of the world a little bit. So, you know, a lot of my poetry initially was about trying to sort of celebrate Filipino culture, a lot of it about identity and about my family, since, you know, growing up, you just suppressed all of that cultural influence, so.
I was wondering what your take on the current state of poetry is with respect to people writing about their ethnicity and celebrating their culture. There was a great deal of that in the 80s and 90s, and I wondered if there's sort of been a shift away from that sort of genre.
Well, you know, that's really funny that you're mentioning that whole multicultural poetry anthology movement. I mean, that's how I got into poetry originally. I was a theater major at NYU, and when I graduated, I couldn't get anything. I couldn't audition for anything except, like, Chino from West Side Story.
And because of your looks.
Because of my looks. And I'm like, I know that I could do more than Chino from West Side Story. So I was like, what am I going to do? And I picked up these poetry anthologies, and there were these Asian American poets. And I thought, well, maybe I can do this. And that's when I started to write the poems. And I just started to perform in every open mic that I could. And then went to the New Eureka Poets Cafe and read my first poem there, and I got a standing ovation. And Chino from West Side Story never gets a standing ovation. And I'm like, you know what? I don't. Whatever this poetry is, I'm doing it.
I'm liking it.
I don't have to audition to write a poem, you know. So that was, like, for me, the whole. It gave me creative control. And, you know, since then, you know, I'm interested in writing plays and going back to theater, you know, 10 years later. And now the whole climate has changed.
How has it changed?
Well, look, in the 70s, everyone wanted to be a rock star. In the 80s, everyone was a performance artist, stand-up comedian. In the 90s, it was that spoken word boom. And I think now, I think technology and I think interdisciplinary and collaboration is sort of the definition. And I think
How does that actually play out, the interdisciplinary, especially where new and digital media are concerned?
Well, I mean, I think, for example, like within theater, I think theater has changed, and a lot of the old theater guards don't know how to look at spoken word or how to really adapt like hip-hop aesthetic spoken word into theater. But that's sort of, hip-hop is an example of this multidisciplinary. You've got a DJ, you've got breakdancers, and people colliding with the story. And I actually feel that the best theater was in the 70s when you had Antazaki Shange for Colored Girls Who've Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow Was Enough, Chorus Line Hair. It was sort of these collage musicals of different writers coming together. So I'm really hoping that that's where we're going now with theater. And I think poetry has a big part of that. And I also feel that not only does theater have to be opened up, but I feel poetry needs to be opened up.
In what way?
Well, I think people are afraid of poetry. You know, I teach poetry workshops at Bellevue Hospital. There's a school for teens who have psychiatric illness there. And it's been a very new thing. They do visual art there because they get visual art. You see the art. But with poetry, it's words. So I guess people are sort of afraid of poetry in some way because it's sort of mysterious and they don't really see it. But for me, what I enjoy doing is having teens actually perform the work. So it becomes not only this dimension of these letters on the page, but sort of their solo play. Like this poem is like your 1 minute theater play. And, you know, being part of a theater company, we do a show called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, 30 plays in 60 minutes. We do a series of 2 minute plays. So we want to sort of, theater is fake. And so in these 2 minute plays, we're always real, we're always ourselves, we're audience participatory, and it becomes really fast and energetic.
Yeah, 30 plays in 60 minutes would be very fast. We're talking to Reggie Kabiko, who will be at the Center for Contemporary Arts tonight at 7 o'clock. I think in the quest to make poetry accessible, the hip-hop aesthetic and sort of performance style has become very dominant in poetry slams and that kind of thing, almost to the extent where things that really shouldn't sound like hip-hop do. But I don't know you know more about this than I do.
Well, you know, I was doing this in 1993, and it was like, when I was slamming, you could still scribble something in your journal, read something at the mic, and then get a 10. These days, it is sort of like the blockbuster slam poem where people are memorized, they've got their big gestures. It's like the blockbuster poem. It's like we've reached, like, where Jaws was in cinema. Like, I like to think that I was, like, in the golden age. And, like, I look at myself as the Brian Boitano of Poetry Slam because I don't want to compete anymore. Like, I've done it. I've done well. I've whatever. But these days,
so you have to be larger than life and have memorized long poems and do them in a very rehearsed style, but still make it seem spontaneous?
And super fast. Yeah. And people have been like, I don't know. But, you know, speaking really fast. And, I mean, there are a lot of different topics to it. You know, again, there's a lot of bad slam poetry out there. But I always find a voice that really sort of connects, someone who's not going through the motions, someone who, like, just has a keen observation as to what's going on.
Which is really what it's all about.
Whenever I go to the National Poetry Slam, I love hearing the poetry from different cities because it sort of gives me the flavor of the city. So, like, that's sort of what I'm looking for. You know, who are you? Like, what is your main concern? And a lot of times people just pick the same topic because it's...
What are some of the most common topics that you hear over and over again in poetry slams?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. Like, the typical... I don't know. Like, well, you have bad erotic poetry. And I'm not even going to go through it right now, but it's...
You don't
it's
have
just,
to read one.
I was honestly, people, and it, people like the shock value of the erotic poem, but it's hard to do it really smart, and it could just be like really one-dimensional. And then there's also like the anti-Bush poems.
Got it. Right.
Especially in D.C. And I remember when Osama bin Laden, when it was 9/11, everyone did, Osama is drama. Osama is drama.
Oh, boy.
And it's like, find another rhyme, you know? So...
Well, you wrote, I was reading one of your statements on the internet, and you said that you still believe that being a gay Asian man, the gay Asian men are hidden in art and mass media, and you're continuing to explore not just race, but sexual identity in post 9/11 New York. And I wondered what the connection was between sexual identity and 9/11, post 9/11.
Well, okay, I've been living in New York for about 18 years, and I would say that I've lived through about three cycles of change, and 9/11 was definitely a change. I feel now like there's this whole gentrification which is driving artists away, and I feel it is yet another challenge in terms of creating your art and in terms of sort of a catalyst. Of it's got to affect artists because we're all driven out of our cities, going to other places, and I feel this exodus sort of informs the race and sexuality on top of that. So yet it's yet another dilemma in terms of being a gay Filipino male. When was the last time you saw a gay Asian male on TV?
Considering that all I watch is South Park, it's not a fair question, but...
I really, you know, and I still have this, like, little fantasy of being on television where I could just be the gay Filipino neighbor on South Park. So if Chef should go, I want to be...
Chef did go.
Well, then it's time for... There should be a gay Filipino who should be catering. Because people don't know about Filipino food, and maybe they can... He could be there. You know, I guess, you know, in terms of Margaret Cho is a comedian, and I love her because she's queer and she has a sexual audacity, and her audiences are always the gay white men, and I'm sort of jealous because I would like, you know, gay white men to be in my audience. I guess I'm
surprised
sort of,
they're not.
Well, you know, my audience are teens and women, and I don't know what that is, but, you know, hey... this poem is called Arctic Lover. After I remove my socks and underwear, he says, I'm not feeling so hot. So that is my poem. It took me 6 years to write. It was actually a short story, and I workshopped it. But I am single and available, and if there's anyone in Santa Fe, I will commute.
We are here at the Santa Fe Bacon Company, ladies and gentlemen. With the handsome and available Reggie Cabico.
He's
a poet who will be reading tonight at 7 o'clock in the Vox Performer Series at the CCA in Santa Fe. Let's hear another poem.
Okay, this is called I Want to Prove Once and For All That I Am Not Crazy. I want to prove that Tyra Banks is not Oprah. I want to prove that airport security checks to see what hotel toiletries you've taken. I want to prove that water extracted from Paris Hilton's pee will sell for $12 a bottle, marketed as pH water, perfectly pH balanced for your celebrity jet-setting lifestyle. I want to prove that Brokeback Mountain lost the Oscar because the Academy hates scenes with sheep. I want to prove that SpongeBob is an Alcoholics Anonymous because he drinks like a fish. I want to prove that Bigfoot is Bea Arthur before she got cast in The Golden Girls. I want to prove that crop circles are the works of alien toddlers practicing their alphabets. I want to prove that Cyndi Lauper will have a big comeback kit called Asian People Just Want to Have Fun, and I will be her backup boy. I want to prove that the devil lives in deviled eggs. I want to prove that the Pope was an extra on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I want to prove that yawning is the best exercise. I want to prove that we are all suffering from a disease called life. I want to prove that Oscar the Grouch is hiding Osama bin Laden. Osama is drama. Osama is drama. Osama is drama. Give me a 10.
He was just kidding on that last part. I would think that when you are writing for performance as opposed to the written page, there's very much the temptation to use humor because you get that audience reaction.
I like using humor because then you know that they're there. And you sort of disarm them. So I love to, first round, do something funny, and then second round, just get serious and serious. And so sort of give them this range was sort of my strategy. So I could never really score a 10 on one poem, but if you give me, like, I'm more the endurance slammer is sort of my strategy, because then I'd like to hit them with different, you know, kinds of poems.
What is the best and deepest connection of reaching an audience and really having a connection with the audience that you've had? I mean, does that happen during poetry slams?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is that the poetry slam, and for those of, you know, for those listening who don't know what it is, it's sort of the Olympics of poetry. A poet has 3 minutes to read his or her own poem before strangers, and you have people in the audience, some of whom know nothing about performance or poetry, judging you. So as the competition narrows, people want to know who's going to win. It's the ultimate reality show live in a cafe or bar. And as it gets closer to the final two, people are on the edge of their seat wondering what's going to happen, what are they going to pull out. And people listen to you in a different way than with those numbers and with the competition. And so for me, that was the fear. That was a double sword. It was like scary, but it was also the delight. And
well, there's an intensity to it. There's a competitiveness to it. I mean, you've mentioned getting a 10 a couple of times during this conversation. But is that where the most realness is? Or is it other kinds of performance venues?
Well, that's one of them. And then, you know, after a slam, you know, people will cry. I mean, people actually cry. Well, you know, that happens in other places. Sometimes I'll read a poem and it'll be about, I'll be in some weird city, I'll be in upstate New York, and I'll read a poem about Filipino identity. And, you know, someone will start crying who's not Filipino. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's sort of the reality or just the genuineness of it. I have no idea. But I'm totally shocked sometimes and moved. So, you know, the connection can happen not just in the poetry slam, but elsewhere in surprising ways.
We're running out of time, but let's hear maybe one more poem before you go.
Sure. Here we go. The government asks me to check one if I want money. I say, how could you ask me to be one race? I stand proudly before you, a fierce Filipino who knows how to belt hard gospel songs played to African drums at a Catholic mass, and loving the music to suffering beats and lashes from men's eyes in the capital streets. Southeast D.C. with its sleepy crime, my mother nursed patients from 7 to 9, patients gray from the railroad riding past civil rights. I walked their tracks when entertained them at the chapel and made their canes pillars of percussion to my heavy gospel. My comedy out loud, laughing about our shared, stolen experiences of the South. Would it surprise you if I told you my blood was delivered from north of Portuguese vessels who gave me spiritual stones and the turn in my eyes, my father's name when they conquered the Pacific Isles? My hair is black and thick as negrito, growing abundant as sampaguita, flowers defying civilization like Filipino pygmies that dance in the mountain. I have danced jigs with Jim Crow and shuffled my hips to the sonic guitar of Clapton and Hendrix, waltzed with dead lovers, skipped to bamboo sticks, ballet kabuki and mayam katakali, arribaderci the rumba and tapped in Pan Alley. And you want me to dance the Bhagavad Gita on a box too small for a thambalina thin diva? I'll check other.
Reggie Kabiko, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And Reggie Kabiko will be speaking, will be reading along with Jimmy Santiago Baca tonight, October 11th at 7 o'clock at Vox Performa Series at the CCA in Santa Fe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I would like now to welcome Peter Danko. He is a furniture designer who will be at the Victoria Price Gallery over the weekend, and Victoria Price joins us also. Welcome both. We're just fiddling with headphones here. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are a furniture designer who does, well, eco-modernism?
Eco-modernism.
Tell us what that word means.
Well, eco-modernism is a, it's kind of a design materiality change from what we're doing now. It's a different approach to how we look at design. And it's two components. One is an aesthetic component, and the other is a component materiality. The aesthetic component is based on the idea that, especially furnishings. Furnishings may not have such a big environmental effect, like, say, gasoline, transportation, architecture, heating houses.
Yeah, furniture, you buy a chair and it sits in your house for the next 35 years.
Yeah, that's true. However, our furnishings sort of, they describe us within our culture. And if we change our furnishings and use sustainable furnishings, then it'll create a mindset with us so we'll look at our entire life in a sustainable manner. And right now, the problem with sustainability is there's no style associated with this sustainability. It seems like if you look at the history of design, every single design movement that is happened because of an effect on our culture. It's like the Pre-Raphaelites what drove the Pre-Raphaelites was social upheaval in the 19th century. And then Art Nouveau was input from science, underwater exploration in the microscope, and Art Nouveau arts and crafts was influence from Japanese, Asian design, and also from a little bit from Art Nouveau, and then there's still a little bit of the Pre-Raphaelite in our design now. In other words, these traditions just don't go away. They've just become part of the mainstream of our culture. Well, with green design and sustainability, there's no style associated with it at all. And it's really, really curious because we're up to this point and it's like we're just switching out materials. It's like this computer here. Instead of making this out of vinyl, we make it out of a more eco-effective plastic. But it really doesn't have, there's no aesthetic component. The only aesthetic component that's around now is sort of like, is using reclaimed wood and things like that. So there's really nothing in that's manufactured that really has a vision for eco-effective design. It's just not there. And that's what eco-modernism about is. I'm suggesting ways that we can do that, and my work does that. It does just exactly that.
Now, one of the things, somebody just actually pulled one of your chairs up to the cafe, to our table at the cafe. And one of the things that I find fascinating about these things, I was over at Victoria Price Gallery yesterday looking at them, is that the woven seat and back of the chair is made out of actual post-industrial seat belt.
That's right.
Materials.
Yes.
But it does not look like something that's recycled or reclaimed. It looks like you would have out of the many materials that one could have chosen, you would have chosen that because it's gorgeous.
It is gorgeous. I I love it because it does what
I... It lasts forever, too.
Yeah, it'll last a long time. It'll never bucket out. I mean, seat belts are immensely strong, and, you know, they're inherently flame retardant. It's just the perfect material. And I was lucky enough to stumble on a source where I can... There's a lot of it around.
Is it material that just simply isn't getting used because, I mean, it's stuff that was left over, or are you having it made for your...
No, I don't have it made at all. It's definitely a remnant. Okay, let's say you're General Motors, and you project you're going to sell 1 million cars this year, and you only sell, like, 750,000, and you have belting left over for 250,000 cars of different colors. So what do you do with it? You know, you can't use it the next model year because, you know, your whole color scheme and everything is changing it. So you try to get rid of it.
You put
sell
it on eBay.
There's people that buy up remnants. And I've found one of these people that buy remnants. And it's not just automobiles. It's airplanes and, you know, industrial vehicles where you belt in. There's just all different kinds of colors. There's also, you know, harnesses for horses. And
now, you also use wood that is ecologically friendly or sustainably harvested wood?
Yes, I do. And all the finishes on the furniture are waterborne, and all the adhesives use polyvinyl acetates instead of using cross-linking mechanisms. That's what makes the glue stick. Instead of formaldehyde or isocyanates.
So you are showing your work at the Victoria Price Gallery. Victoria, tell us how you came across Peter's work.
Well, you know, I'd been looking to carry a green furniture maker, and I've always felt that it's so interesting that the world seems to make it difficult for us to be virtuous. I always thought that when I lived in the Santa Fe County limits and I had to schlep all my recycling to the dump, and they would always yell at you if you had one wrong thing in one bin. And it felt the same way with green furniture design, that I found some interesting green furniture makers. However, the prices were ridiculous, and I thought, you know, if somebody wants to support our environment and be green, why should they pay a premium for doing that? And Peter's design is in, his work is in the Museum of Modern Art, it's in the Cooper Hewitt, it's in the Smithsonian. His design is incredible, but the best part about the whole thing for me is it's affordable. It's really affordable for somebody to decide to buy an entire dining room set or to furnish a commercial space. Peter does furnishings for whole restaurants and other commercial applications.
Well, I would think for restaurants they'd be good because those seat belts and so on last forever.
They hold up very well. I guess maybe 20-some years ago, I did a Westlake shopping center in Seattle. And I was there a couple weeks ago, and those chairs are still there. And it's in a, you know, shopping mall is sort of like chair hell. That's where they go to be destroyed in 20 years.
You might as well just bring a sledgehammer to them.
Yeah, probably it wouldn't hurt them. Dent them up.
You will be speaking tomorrow at 4 o'clock, giving a talk called Eco-Modernism. And from 5 to 7, there will be a block party in conjunction with Santa Fe Modern Home. And this is at your gallery?
It is. We're in Pacheco Park on Pacheco Street, and Santa Fe Modern Home and I are across the sort of the driveway, the parking lot from each other. And so we're going to have a block party flowing back and forth. And Jan is going to DJ, and we're going to have a cash bar, and it's going to be a design week party tomorrow night.
And that's at 1512 Pacheco Street. Building B is right on Pacheco, between San Mateo and Alta Vista.
Exactly.
And Victoria Price, Art and Design. Peter Danko and Victoria Price, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with author Robert Olin Butler. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome by telephone Robert Olin Butler. He's a fiction writer and winner of many awards, including a Pulitzer Prize in 1993. And he will be here this Saturday night in an event for Narrative Magazine, which also features Ann Beatty, Dan Gerber, and Arthur Z. That's this Saturday from 6:30 to 9:30 at the El Dorado Hotel. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure.
You started off as a theater person. How did you become a writer of novels and short stories?
Well, yes, my first ambition was to be an actor, and frankly, events like this make the ham sizzle hotly in me. I still enjoy performing for my work. But I was at Northwestern University and decided, after having some success as an actor, that I'd rather write. And I assumed, therefore, that I wanted to write plays. Went off and got a master's degree at the University of Iowa, and I was an absolutely terrible playwright. That's one of the reasons that I started writing fiction. But I think I was always a closeted fiction writer, because the one reason I was so terrible as a playwright is that my most impassioned writing was going into the stage directions. You know, that's a bad bad sign for a playwright.
Right.
So I finally realized I wanted to control every moment. So that means fiction.
Now, you've been quoted as saying that your early work included 5 ghastly novels and about 40 dreadful short stories and 12 truly awful full-length plays.
Yeah, I always alluded already to the awful plays. See how fast we get to this?
Well, is that false modesty, or do you think your early work was really that bad?
No, it wasn't. It's not false modesty. I might be exaggerating slightly, but not much. You know, line to line, I probably showed some promise of being able to put decent sentences together. But in terms of the essential things for an artist, the work was just utterly wrong-headed. I teach creative writing. Indeed, I've done so for 22 years, and I do it somewhat differently than other people do. I don't emphasize, although I'm glad to get this from other people, I don't emphasize the craft of technique as much as the process. And I think, indeed, I've been influenced by my early acting training, because a book of my lectures on the creative process for fiction writers came out. It's called From Where You Dream, but my working title was Method Writing, because
very interesting.
I use the same insights that Stanislavski brought to the acting art back at the beginning of the 20th century. And so the thing that happened was I stopped writing from my head and started writing from the place where art comes from, which is your unconscious, your own deeply ingrained sense memory. And that's the inside of method acting. It's the inside of the way I teach creative writing. And it was the thing that turned in me that made me from a really, not a really bad writer into a good one.
It's interesting. I've often wondered how close the art of novel writing, fiction writing, and acting are, because in both cases you have to really get inside the head and soul of people who you are not.
Exactly, and even if you're writing in the third person, you're inhabiting a persona, a narrative persona. So even the third person narrator is an implicit character and voice that you are inhabiting and speaking through. And so it's not just applicable to first-person narration.
Now, you work with some interesting premises. The folks from Narrative Magazine sent me one series called Intercourse, which is pairs of short pieces in which you imagine the interior monologues of pairs of people who are about to get together in one way or another.
No, not about to. In media res. It's actually during the act.
Oh, okay.
My previous book was called Severance, and that was a book of very short stories in the voices of recently severed heads, based on the premise, and this is true. I mean, there are a lot of scientists who believe that, or at least did certainly during the heyday of the guillotine, that there was enough blood left in a brain to sustain consciousness for a certain amount of time. So I wrote 62 short stories in the voices of such internal monologues. And as William Butler Yeats once said, that sex and the dead are the only things that can interest a serious mind. So I did my dead book, and this is the sex book. But yes, it's 100 very short stories in 50 couples. And the book Severance was not really about the fall of the blade, and Intercourse is not really about what the bodies are actually doing, although somewhat implied at times, but it's really about that deep internal wandering consciousness during the act, where one reassesses oneself or reexamines oneself as prompted by what, the kind of attempted intimacy and connection that's going on. So I'm going to read from some of those couples on Saturday night.
Some of the couples are made up, like Santa Claus and one of the elves. And then
That's not made up.
Oh, you.
This is true.
Tell me more about that.
By the way, it's a female elf. I hasten to add, I'm not outing Santa here.
Right, right.
But it's interesting. And Tom, of course, is publishing, has published or about to publish, I guess, a number of these couples, and he's doing them as narrative, certainly, and there's some more couples going into the December fiction issue of Playboy as short stories. But David Baker out at the Canyon Review is publishing them as poetry. That they are very unusual forms, although I have a kind of aesthetic of the short story that I can distinguish between a prose poem and a short story. But I'm doing couples that range from Adam and Eve and Anthony and Cleopatra, Lita and the Swan, up through I do Bill and Hillary and George and Laura, as a matter of fact, in the book. And
do we have
lots
to
of
read
them in
them?
Between? Pardon?
Do we have to read those?
You don't have to, but I think you would be charmed and delighted by it because you don't have to think about George's physical makeup here. You are in deep inside his psyche, and you can ignore what's actually going on very readily. But I was happy to research the book for a variety of reasons, but one of them is that every couple in the book, I have found at least clear circumstantial evidence that they were couples. And so there are some surprising ones. In fact, Saturday night, I'm going to read Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman.
Well, that was very surprising. What do you know about that? I mean, what
research? Well, in 1883, Wilde wrote a letter to a friend saying, now Wilde came on a big speaking tour of the United States in 1883, and then he came back later that year at the for the opening of a play of his in New York. And he made a second visit to Walt, and on that visit he went out and spent several hours with him at where Walt lived in Camden, New Jersey. And he wrote a letter to a friend saying that he had just left Whitman's presence and with his kiss still burning on his lips. So I took that absolute sufficient evidence to suggest that the two of them did actually get it on in 1883. And there are other really interesting ones. Here's one that is in the book. I'm not reading this next week, tomorrow night, but in 1935, a neophyte Danish journalist, she was a neophyte journalist at Forumist Denmark, 22 years old. She, in 1935, interviewed and then boffed on his office floor Adolf Hitler.
No.
Yes. 7 years later, you think that's surprising. 7 years later, and I swear this is, I mean, there's 7 years later in a hotel room in Charleston, South Carolina, and I choose this room for a reason that will be clear in a minute, because this was at the end of a six-month raging affair. The same Inga Arvad, 7 years later, 1942, was in the midst of an affair with a very young Navy ensign named John F. Kennedy. There is, Mary Charlotte, 1 degree of coital separation between Adolf Hitler and John Kennedy.
Oh,
the story
Lord.
Gets stranger.
No, this is true.
This is absolutely true. Absolutely true. And in fact, what I'm about to say is even the Freedom of Information Act has long ago yielded transcripts of this. In that hotel room in Charleston, there was a microphone hidden, unbeknownst to the two lovers. Because, not surprisingly, Inga Arvad was a suspected Nazi spy. And at the other end of the microphone, of course, was J. Edgar Hoover. So in the book, which is called Intercourse, will be out next April, from Chronicle Books, in the book, I've got Adolf and Inga, Jack and Inga, and J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson, his lifelong companion. And it was in 1935, 1942, and J. Edgar and Clyde are doing this in 1946 when J. Edgar Hoover, when John Kennedy has just been elected to Congress, and J. Edgar is, of course, in his mind, and J. Edgar Hoover's biographies say several of them do, that he listened to the John Kennedy Inga Arvad tape over and over and over again. So you can imagine what might be on J. Edgar's mind.
It's an interesting project because, I mean, so many people in the society are voyeuristic about the sex lives of the famous, and you're turning it into literature rather than bad TV.
Exactly, or computer blogging. Yes, this is, and I do take it seriously. It's because it's not about bodies. You're not going to have any graphic descriptions of sex here. What is going on? As it was with Severance. I look for those moments when human beings are most intensely conscious of self, and their deepest yearnings for an identity or a place in the universe are prompted to the surface. And, you know, if your head has just been cut off and the life has just ended and you've got, you know, a minute and a half left to think, that's obviously a circumstance in which that happens. Also, the circumstance in which all of us are driven in one way or another to try to connect to the other through, in this case, sexual intercourse. And it's that act, but going on deep inside, and it's that voice I find in the book, we are yearning to define ourselves, to figure out who we are and answer that question that terrifies us, is that are we actually, in fact, alone on this planet? And that's what's the essence of these little stories, and some of them are very funny, and some of them are very poignant, and some of them are both at the same time.
Well, there's one that I found intriguing, which was the 23-year-old Milton Berle and the 40-year-old evangelist Amy Semple McPherson.
Yes, yes.
Tell us more.
There's a chapter in Milton Berle's memoir about this. You know, Amy was quite a gal. She was. You know, she preached a gospel of love and connectedness and then acted that out in her own wonderfully inspired ways. But remember, she's the one who feigned her own kidnapping in order to spend some time with her lover back in the 30s. And so, actually late 20s. And she was one of the early, you know, radio evangelists. She was the forerunner of all the Jimmy Swaggerts and so forth of today. And a fascinating connection, yes. And Milton, of course, was famous for his affairs.
And his comedy, which you lace throughout
yes.
the stories.
He cannot stop doing his comic shtick, even in the midst of sex.
I have to ask you one thing, which you alluded to a moment ago. You said there's a difference between a prose poem and a very short story.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is this, is that, in essence, the essence of fiction as a narrative is that it's built on character, and it's about characters who yearn. I've used that word before. Fiction is a temporal art form. It exists in time. People move forward in time. And if you've got an art form that's about human beings and it's about human feelings, which no one questions about fiction, and if you're moving forward, and if you're inevitably moving forward in time with human beings and their feelings, any Buddhist will tell you that as a human being with feelings, we cannot exist for even 30 seconds of time on planet Earth without desiring something. My favorite word in this regard is yearning, because it suggests the deepest level of desire. So fiction is the art form of human yearning. And then you put that together with James Joyce's notion of the epiphany, something which is a shining forth. The fiction moves to a moment when some aspect of the human condition shines forth in its essence, and that's true. But I'd say there are two epiphanies in every great work of fiction. There's that one, and there's an epiphany at the very near the beginning where the yearning of the character shines forth, and we settle into that character for the narrative ride. And so, a prose poem does not need human beings even in it. But if it's got human beings, it does not need to find the narrative drive of desire. It can move around other aspects of the human condition. But if you have a short piece and it's got a character who yearns, then you have a work of fiction. Now, because of the extreme brevity of the short, the two epiphanies I just described may well, in fact, characteristically in the short, do, may happen at the same moment. The final epiphany in the short may be the epiphany of yearning. But yearning is the essence of plot. It is the essence of narrative and fiction. And if that's present, if you can discern what the character desires in the short piece, then you're in the presence of fiction.
We're talking to author Robert Olin Butler. You're going to be here on Saturday night in a benefit for Narrative Magazine. And a few days ago, we were talking on the air with Tom Jenks of Narrative Magazine about the relationship between the literary world and digital media. You started out writing your novels on longhand and legal pads. What is your relationship to digital media right now as a writer?
I adore it. And indeed, my belief is that the future of literary fiction is on the internet. Anyone will tell you, for the last 20 years, we've been in a long decline in this country in terms of literary fiction, as far as the print media is concerned. The big publishing houses are all in the hands of serious, conglomerates, many of them German, whatever reason. And literary fiction is absolutely being elbowed out of, in any serious way, out of mainstream print publishing. But and the whole world, eventually mainstream print publishing will all be digital. If you look 10 or 15 years down the road, and the iPod is an extraordinary object. And I just bought my first Sony ebook reader, which is also an extraordinary object. I was in Southeast Asia for 3 weeks traveling for the State Department as a literary envoy, and I took 166 books with me in the palm of my hand. And when battery technology and display technology, and the ebook reader is pretty good in both those things, but when it becomes just stunningly beautiful, and you can carry 10,000 books around with you and be interested in a book and just push a button, and anywhere you are in the world, you can download a new book into the palm of your hand. And these objects, and I adore ink and paper. My book Severance from Chronicle Books last fall was the best-smelling book ever published. I smell books. I inhale them.
Right.
But I'm sorry. That world is passing away, And our tactile experience with books will turn into the tactile experience with industrial objects. The iPod is a beautiful thing. And the important thing is the writer puts words together in a certain order, which then go into the inner consciousness of the reader and create these experiences. And the mode of transference is unimportant in that.
Right.
And the fact is that the internet is a genius for bringing together like-minded people. A woman is a multi-billionaire today because she was having trouble finding other Pez candy dispenser collectors. I'm talking about one of the founders of eBay. And the internet's a genius of bringing like-minded people together. That's how people who will forever love literary fiction, but they can find each other on the internet. Tom is proving that with Narrative Magazine right now. And in terms of literary fiction books, where the Barnes & Nobles and Borders of the world are reluctant to stock literary fiction, but when they do, it's two copies that last about 8 weeks on the shelf, and anyone who loves literary fiction has got to wander in and accidentally somehow find those books. It's no longer an operable model for getting readers of literary fiction to the real books. The model will be the internet. You can find, and Tom's already got, 30,000 subscribers?
That's
and it's
right.
Going up quickly. And those are self-selected people who love literary fiction.
Unfortunately, it's actually time to go. So sorry to cut you off. We're just a minute before the end of our program.
So
no, it's wonderful to have you on the air, Robert Olin Butler. And we will see you on Saturday night at the El Dorado Hotel at the event for Narrative Magazine.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us. And we've been talking to Robert Olin Butler, who's the author. If you want to find out more about the Narrative Magazine event on Saturday night, you can call the following number, area code 530-895-3381, or write to party@narrativemagazine.com. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's my website. You can listen to the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Tad Dameron. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow with Robert Knott and lots of other good stuff. Keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR, ksfr.org. Hasta la vista. Ciao.